Welcome once again to our series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. This is our 18th in the series, and our theologian in residence once again is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High Bible apologetics and history. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church. Ron, we've been talking about the Bible and people who have influenced it through the ages. Perhaps you could give us a summary of where we are and up to this 18th series, because we've been dealing with some really influential people who have planted seeds that have still growing in our times. Some were wheat seeds and some were darnel or weed seeds, and we're trying to separate the wheat from the chaff or the wheat from the weeds. So could you give us a little summary of where we've been?
We set out as the purpose of this series to inform our listeners about how some secular Protestant and Catholic philosophers and biblical scholars have misinformed the public over the past 300 years about interpreting the Bible. Unfortunately, millions have had their faith shaken or even lost because of this. And we had hoped that providing this information would help our listeners recognize the misinformation disseminated today in countless books, magazines, newspaper articles, magazine and newspaper articles, public gatherings, seminars, television and radio programs. Misinformation that is based on the false presuppositions and flawed methodologies of all too many scholars. Although most, if not all, of these scholars claim to be objective, many, if not most, of them had or have liberal, social, political, and economic agendas that they are promoting. We hope that the information we provide will help our listeners strengthen and defend their faith. After looking at biblical scholarship and interpretation in the early church to the time of the Renaissance and Protestant Reformation, we focused on the philosophers and biblical scholars of the 18th century Enlightenment, who started in the wrong direction by denying that truth or reality that exists outside the human mind can be known with any degree of certainty. We looked at philosophers like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Rene Descartes, Benedict Spinoza, David Hume, and Immanuel Kant, among others. They totally separated philosophy from theology, science from religion, and faith from reason. Now, this has had a huge impact on many biblical scholars, Catholic and Protestant alike, who began the process of questioning the objective truth contained in the Bible because the events described therein had existed outside the human mind, thus unknowable. Since the world outside the human mind was closed off from direct contact, those philosophers and biblical scholars who continued to believe in the truth of the Bible, they had to find some way to support their belief. And following Kant's lead, they found support for the truth of their faith in some inner light, such as intuition or individual or collective conscience or feelings, emotions, and the like. And that's true even down to the present day.
Okay, Ron, well, I think it's a nice summary of where we've been and how important the subject we're talking about, because we're still living with these dragon seeds that were planted and are blossoming still in our culture today. I think we're trying to explain also, as Benedict XVI has said, how we got, or that we are right now, in the situation of the dictatorship of relativism, that there we can't really know truth. It's very subjective. Each person makes up our own truth and leads to chaos, particularly in morality. Well, let's take a summary of the 18th century Enlightenment before we go to the 19th century. Can you give us a little background on this 18th century Enlightenment we've been talking about?
Yes, we've spent probably 10 or 12, at least 8 or 10 half-hour sessions on the Enlightenment because it is so important. It's a real watershed. in terms of thinking in general, of intellectual thinking in general, and biblical scholarship in particular, in our particular case, of course. But it's a very complex subject, and we've tried to simplify it as much as possible. Father Robert O'Donnell, in his wonderful little book called Hooked on Philosophy, subtitled Thomas Aquinas Made Easy, which still isn't very easy, says that, quote, "The most basic question in all of philosophy is this: does a real world exist apart from my knowledge of it?" End of quote. And of course, we've been looking at some philosophers who claim that it doesn't, contrary to what the Catholic Church had said from at least the time of Augustine down to St. Thomas Aquinas and the philosophy of realism. He says that philosophers had given to this question two positions, quote, two positions which are diametrically opposed to one another, realism and idealism, end of quote. In regard to realism, according to Father O'Donnell, Aristotle and St. Thomas, I'm talking about St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, and many philosophers who followed them have answered that, quote, universal ideas correspond to the material objects in the real world, from which my mind abstracted them in the first place, end of quote. In other words, the realist believes that that which is in the mind really exists outside the mind, that it corresponds to what is in the real world. And it is called realism because it's real.
Okay, and this seems so simple, I think, in terms of, well, surely we can know things outside of ourselves. But what we're dealing with is going to say, no, we really can't know things outside of ourselves.
Yeah, the Church has always said that, you know, we have our senses, God-given senses, and they are designed in a way so that we can know what's outside there really is what is outside. On the other hand, you're having people starting out with Descartes and then, of course, going into Hume and then, of course, Kant, who are arguing, of course, that this is not the case, that because the human senses are so limited in many ways and because our minds have prejudices and presuppositions and all that kind of thing, that what does come in, what does stream in from the outside through our senses, we really can't know that with a high degree of certainty. We impose our subjectivity on it. And so therefore, it's not what really is out there does not necessarily correspond with what's in here. All that we can really know is our own experiences, our own feelings and emotions, and our own ideas that are inside of our mind, which may or may not correspond with what's outside there.
It certainly creates problems when I go to the store, if that's a $20 bill or a $10 bill, if I really can't know what's out there. Okay, what is the universal ideas that we've been discussing so far?
Well, ideas come up several times, universal ideas. They have been defined as, quote, whatever is common to many, or some, one thing that is common to many, and that one be in many are applied to many, end of quote. We'll explain that. Father O'Donnell says that, quote, the more material a thing is, the less knowable it is. To know material things, the human intellect must dematerialize them. Our universal ideas are the result of the intellect stripping away from our sense images all the matter, that is, you know, the material that makes it up, mm-hmm. which identifies mm-hmm. them as individual material things, end of quote. Now, we'll illustrate this. In other words, we'll illustrate the meaning of universal ideas. He gives an example of the universal idea of dog. The concept dog corresponds to the nature or the essence of my particular dog, which he gives a name, Spot, from which my mind abstracted the idea of dog. Recall that nature is that which makes something what it is and not something else. And the bodies of humans and dogs are composed of matter, made up of material, made up of substances. But each possesses different natures, which makes one a human being and the other a dog. In other words, dog is a universal idea that doesn't exist in the real world. But once one has the idea of dog in his mind, he can reapply this. The technical word they use in philosophy is they can predicate it. to every dog that has existed in the past, that exists in the present, or that might exist in the future. So that is why we call dog or any other concept a universal or general idea that applies to all dogs. And why it is such a useful tool in expanding our knowledge of the real world in which we live. In the quote, I was quoting Father O'Donnell there. Of course, the universal idea of human being can be reapplied or predicated to any particular human being who's ever lived and will ever live. And this approach to reality has been called Aristotelian or Thomistic, named after St. Thomas Aquinas, realism.
Okay, it sounds like that we're talking in a way that almost takes us out of this world, how we know things. But it has tremendous repercussions on what we conclude is real or not real. Didn't we discuss that the philosophy of realism was challenged during the Enlightenment of the 17th and 18th century?
Yes, it was. In fact, that's why it's such a watershed century, why it's so important. From the beginning of the church all the way up until the time of René Descartes, let's say, this idea of realism, of course, went pretty much unchallenged. The idea that we can know what's outside of our minds with a high degree of certainty, maybe with absolute certainty in some ways, when we apply it to faith. Father O'Donnell tells us that all of this changed in the 17th century, when René Descartes and other philosophers began to abandon Aristotelian or Thomistic realism. Father O'Donnell says that Descartes thought of himself as a realist, but he, quote him here, quote, held that certain of our universal ideas come to us not from our sense contact with the material world, but rather from God. These are innate ideas which are clear and distinct and are consistently true. The truths of my innate ideas is guaranteed by the source of them, God himself, end of quote. And, you know, we talked about Descartes and his ideas, innate ideas, so we won't, of course, repeat all that right now. But as we discussed in some detail when considering Descartes in earlier sessions of this series, he didn't trust knowledge obtained from the senses and wrote in some detail why he believed them to be unreliable, which we shared a little bit of that in our session or two. We concluded our discussion of Descartes by saying that he got scholars thinking in the wrong direction because although he thought he was saving religion for people that were becoming more skeptical by the day, he in fact introduced a philosophy that undermined religion. Because if we can't know with certainty what exists outside of our minds, how can we know that what is in the Bible is true, or even that God exists? You might recall Descartes had a way of doing that. In other words, with his innate ideas and what have you. But on the other hand, of course, other people come along and pick up that same methodology and they strip it of its religious content.
So, as you mentioned, Descartes wasn't trying to destroy God or immortality of the soul and those things, but he invented a system or a methodology that actually led to that.
He thought he was saving a religion, specifically the Catholic religion, in a skeptical age. People who were beginning to doubt for many different reasons the truth of the Bible, or even that God exists. He got around this problem himself by formulating the idea that knowledge of God is innate in the human mind. But as I said a while ago, later philosophers stripped all of the religious content from his philosophy. And his philosophy has been called rationalism, meaning that knowledge is a product of reason or the workings of the mind. And that doesn't necessarily have any real connection, you know, with anything objective outside of the mind. Father O'Donnell concludes his discussion of Descartes by saying, quote him, though the father of modern rationalism certainly cannot be blamed for the move away from Christianity, it is difficult not to acknowledge that he created the climate in which in the modern era such estrangement became possible, end of quote. Then he goes on to say, quote, it does not happen right away, but gradually. In fact, about 150 years after Descartes, all that was fundamentally Christian in the tradition of European thought had already been pushed aside. This was the time of the Enlightenment, in France, where pure rationalism held sway. The French Revolution during the Reign of Terror knocked down the altars dedicated to Christ, tossed crucifixes into the street, introduced the cult of the goddess Reason. And on the basis of this, there was a proclamation of liberty, equality, and fraternity. The spiritual patrimony, and in particular the moral patrimony of Christianity, were thus torn from their evangelical foundation. In order to return Christianity to its full vitality, it is essential that these return to their foundation, end of quote. And as we discussed earlier, Kant's idealism was to later close all the windows of access which the human mind had to the real world.
It's a powerful description of what was happening.
Yes, in my class on world history, we spent a lot of time on this period right here because it was during the period of time that rather successful attempts were made to try to destroy Christianity, especially Catholic Christianity. Then we discussed the 17th century English philosopher John Locke, who invented the modern version of empiricism by claiming that all knowledge was the product of the senses. In other words, he's taking the opposite view than Descartes. He believed that the human mind was like a, quote, blank tablet, or a white sheet, in Latin, tabula rasa, on which was written everything perceived by the senses, but thought that the mind had the ability to take raw sensory data that streamed into the mind and formed it into more complex ideas, secondary, primary and secondary ideas, that kind of thing. And he denied Descartes' idea of innate ideas. And a little after Locke, a Scotsman named David Hume, who, as Father O'Donnell states, quote, struck another blow at realism by insisting that we cannot perceive and therefore we cannot know the relationship of an effect to its cause. Our only perception is of succession in space and time. One thing exists before another thing does. But there is no justification for concluding that the former is the cause of the latter, end of quote. And as we said at the time, by denying that we can know the causes of things by seeing their effects, Hume was destroying the possibility of reasoning back to the first cause of all things, of course, which is God. He basically was destroying natural theology. And he was also destroying belief in the Bible, because the Bible also exists outside the mind and all the things that it describes, of course. However, as Father O'Donnell tells us, it was the German Immanuel Kant, quote, who sounded the death knell of realism, end of quote, in the 18th century. And as we discussed earlier, Kant maintained that, quote, I'll quote here, the concept of connection between cause and effect is by no means the only one through which the understanding thinks, connections between things a priori, end of quote. And Father O'Donnell says by this, he meant that the world as we know it, which he called the phenomenal world, is structured not only by the secondary sense qualities of Locke, but not only by the causal intelligible category of Hume, but by every category into which we classify the world in knowing it. In other words, color, odor, taste, time, space, substance, accidents, relationships, action, passion, and so on. These are known as the categories, of course, and Aristotle had originally developed this idea, to my knowledge, and St. Thomas, of course, picked up on it considerably. And you could boil, of course, St. Thomas's down to just substance and accident, but we needn't go into that here. The nominal world, which is the world as it exists in itself apart from our knowledge of it, does not fall into any of these categories, any of these classifications. It is a totally unstructured world to which human knowledge has no access whatsoever. I do not discover the world as the realists maintain, I invent it. I was basically quoting Father O'Donnell there.
Why, what a distinction. I don't discover the real world, I just invent it.
Yeah, if you say that, well, I can't know anything with any certainty from outside, and everything streams in through my senses, which are, you know, really limited in their ability, and not only that, then I let my prejudices and all kinds of things like that. What you're really doing then, you can construct reality any way you want. And that's where you get into pure subjectivism. That's where you get into pure relativism. Everything becomes relative to time and place and circumstance and situation and context and consequence and what have you.
But as strange to say, that is where we are right now in a kind of a world thought pattern.
Oh, well, certainly.
There isn't any truth. Jesus said the truth will make us free. This is saying that there isn't any truth. I just invent it. I make it up. Subjectively, what I think is true, what subjectively you think is true, it can be just the opposite.
Well, like Descartes, Kant thought he was saving religion from a skeptical world, but inadvertently he was contributing to its demise. And to make our point, I'll quote the famous 20th century realist philosopher Alfred North Whitehead once again, who we quoted once before, who said of Kant's 18th century idealism, quote, "It has held its own as the guiding principle of scientific studies ever since," which would include biblical scholarship, of course. "It is still reigning. Every university in the world organizes itself in accordance with it. No alternative system of organizing the pursuit of scientific truth has been suggested. It is not only reigning, but it is without a rival. And yet it is quite unbelievable," end of quote. No. I might add that this applies equally to modern biblical scholars as well, including most Catholic ones. And as we conclude our discussion of Kant, as we concluded it, his idealism contributed to the development of modern skepticism, materialism, scientism, pragmatism, subjectivism, and relativism, all harmful, even deadly to humans and to our faith.
And that's where we get into this pattern of don't judge others. Because what I may think is right, that's okay for me, but it isn't necessarily right for somebody else. Same-sex marriage, if I'm against it, okay, but if another person is for it, okay. There isn't any truth that we can attain, and that leads to moral chaos. Well, hasn't our last two popes, John Paul II the Great and Benedict XVI, frequently warned us about these and other actually poisonous philosophies?
They certainly have. For as Father O'Donnell tells us, there is a lot at stake here. He quotes St. Thomas Aquinas as saying that the, quote, "the human person is the most perfect being in all of nature." And then Father O'Donnell states that, quote, "man is the pinnacle of God's creation, made, as the book of Genesis tells us, in the image and likeness of God. But a man living in the ideal world of Descartes, Locke, Hume, and Kant is a very different creature than a man living in the real world of Aristotle and St. Thomas. To begin with, in the real world, the human mind discovers the causal links between the effects and their causes. This enables it to reason to the existence of God as the first cause of all the finite effects which are perceptible in the world. In the idealist world, the human mind invents or fashions the finite objects which it cannot conclude are effects of any cause. In an ideal world, there can be no rational proofs for the existence of God," end of quote.
I like your quotes from this Father O'Donnell. what's the name of his book again? Thomas Aquinas Made Easy?
Yes.
Okay. I'll have to get a copy of that.
Well, Father O'Donnell, he makes another important point regarding the detrimental effects of idealism, and that is the adverse effects it had on the ideas of the natural law. Regarding this matter, he writes, quote, "It is equally difficult in an ideal world to find any rational basis for human freedom. St. Thomas explains that God is not only the creator who brings the universe into being out of nothing, but he is also the conserver of everything. He creates a finite being does not contain within itself the power to preserve itself in being. That requires an infinite power, just as does creating out of nothing. As a conserver of creation, God is also the lawmaker who governs what he creates. That eternal law of God is discoverable by man, at least in part, by his use of his natural reason. And that discoverable part of God's eternal law, St. Thomas calls the natural law." He goes on to quote St. Thomas writing on this matter, quote, "The light of natural reason alone by which we discern what is good and evil is a function of the natural law, which is an imprint on us a divine light, end of quote. You know, you've heard it many times said that the natural law is the law of God written on our hearts.
Conscience,
yes. Father O'Donnell concludes that, quote, if, as Kant maintains, we have no intellectual access to the nominal world, that is, the world in itself, as God has created it, then it becomes impossible to discover in that world natural law.
Okay, and then that brings us, obviously, to the situation. Hasn't there been a vigorous, strong effort in the past two centuries to revive Aristotelian and Thomistic realism, which has lain asleep for more than 500 years?
Yes, there has. For example, in 1889, Pope Leo XIII asked Monsignor Mercier of Belgium to found an institute of philosophy at the University of Louvain. And Mercier later was made a cardinal. And the purpose of the institute was to focus attention on the study of medieval philosophy, especially that of St. Thomas Aquinas. Sometimes that whole movement's called the Neo-Thomas or the Neo-Scholastic movement. For more than a century, this institute published many philosophical books and articles placing emphasis on the history of philosophy. The two outstanding persons connected with the Neo-Thomistic movement of the 20th century were the Frenchman Jacques Maritain and Antoine Gilson. Maritain was a convert who devoted his entire life to the study of Thomism and of its application to all aspects of contemporary life. Father O'Donnell tells us that he was strenuously opposed to idealism, about which he said had abandoned the proper function of the human reason. And in his renowned book, Metaphysics, he championed the idea of a Christian philosophy. In his book, Crossing the Threshold of Hope, Pope John Paul II attributes the de-Christianization of Europe to modern immanentism and subjectivism. By immanentism, the Pope means, quote, a method of establishing the credibility of the Christian faith by appealing to the subjective satisfaction that the faith gives to a believer. Father Hardin says in his Modern Catholic Dictionary, quote, this method tends to ignore, if not deny, the corresponding value of objective criteria for accepting divine revelation, notably miracles and prophecies, end of quote. Well, then the Pope continues in his crossing the threshold of hope. Quote, we find ourselves on the threshold of modern immanentism and subjectivism. As we stressed in an earlier session, Descartes turned his back on metaphysics or realism and often called ontology or the science of being, and instead emphasized the philosophy of knowledge, often called epistemology. And Kant's idealism was the most notable representative of this movement, and we have already discussed in some detail how idealism adversely affected biblical interpretation. And if we can't know with any degree of certainty what exists outside of our minds, how can we know with certainty that the stories found in the Bible are true, or even that there is a God?
Many thanks. Our time has run out. May God bless you all, always and in all ways.